tell the story. Not long ago, high on the mountain in Idaho, in Idaho, I was living free. So I sold a shotgun to a deputy.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please don't shoot me down.
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 Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge. Please don't shoot me down.
My good dog killed my boy, my only son, my pride and joy. They shot my wife dead on the floor, holding her baby in the cabin door.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please, please don't shoot me down.
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 Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please don't shoot me down. And you want to go build a cabin in Idaho, in Idaho. If you're living free, boys, I'll sell no shotgun, no deputy.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge. Please don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down. Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge. Please don't shoot me down.
Good evening. This is Truth Quest with Melody and Professor Eric Carlstrom. And tonight, this is KHEN LP 106.9 Salida. It's 25 degrees out there. I was looking at the temperature in here. And I also wanted to read a disclaimer before we get started with our guest, because we have a very interesting guest tonight named Bill Fox. And the disclaimer is the opinions expressed by the host and guests on this show do not necessarily represent the views of KHEN, its staff, or board of directors. Bill, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay. And
center.
Bill Fox is has been served in the Marines and has been a stockbroker and lives out on the West Coast and has been participating in some activities that had to do with some drills with our government, and I will go ahead and let him finish describing his background here.
All right. Well, actually, I got drafted to appear on the show by Captain Eric May, the leader of Ghost Troop, who was originally slated to take the second hour, but unfortunately he is suffering from Lou Gehrig's disease, which is terminal, and he's a very brilliant individual. He's done very heroic work in terms of promoting citizen vigilance regarding possible false flag operations by the U.S. government. I'm aware that Dr. Carlstrom has done heroic work exposing the evidence that 9/11 was an inside job. Once the person buys into that premise that, in fact, it involved, in all likelihood, controlled demolition and remotely navigated aircraft, and in all likelihood, I subscribe to the theory, as does Michael Collins Piper, a person I'd like to discuss later, whose e-books I carry, that it was in all likelihood orchestrated by Mossad, along with certain elements of the CIA. and that furthermore, that we have received repeated warnings that it's not a matter of if, but when there'd be another nuclear strike in America, that it seems wise for people to be extra vigilant, to be looking for intelligence indicators, to try to anticipate, rather than just passively wait for another strike on one of our cities, to try to anticipate when other strikes might take place and thwart them. After all, if we're proven wrong, it seems like we're going overboard in our vigilance. It seems like the cost of doing that in terms of possible embarrassment are minuscule compared to the cost the other way, where, let's say, we're not vigilant enough and we actually get hit with a nuke and thousands, if not tens or hundreds of thousands of Americans die. And furthermore, we could have a justification for a full-scale martial law clampdown and the end of freedom as we know it here in America. And that's the last thing we want, is to lose all our freedom and get plunged into World War III to boot. All kinds of horrible things. So I first became aware of Captain May's activities when I was surfing the Internet last mid-August, and I saw a map which depicted a Harvard and Stanford study of potential fallout from a 10-kiloton bomb in Portland. And at that time, I actually lived about 8 miles from the alleged Ground Zero. And I read about many of Captain May's activities trying to thwart potential false flag operations, and I had been around the track enough in terms of citizen activism and ideological explorations that I could read between the lines and fully appreciate what he was trying to accomplish. So I surfed the net to find a number for Captain May, and lo and behold, was able to locate one and left a message, and he responded, and we hit it off right away, both of us having a military background. I got up to the rank of major in the Marine Corps before I received an honorable discharge, and I had served in active duty for about 5 years and another 10 years in reserves, and had done, in addition to being involved in supply and logistics, I had also did a brief stint in a military intelligence-related billet where I was the officer in charge of an interrogation translation team for 2 years. In any event, in chatting with Captain May, he pointed out that there was an operation, Noble Resolve, which was coming up very shortly, in a matter of days, it would kick off, and there was nobody to represent the media that he knew of that would go down to Salem, Oregon, the capital of Oregon, to the National Guard headquarters and ask some very important questions to get inside their decision cycle, so to speak, of people who might be involved in one way or the other with what could possibly be hijacked as a false flag operation. So I was in turn put in touch with Leon Smith, the editor of the Lone Star Iconoclast.
And for
the,
we had him
press
on,
credentials.
Yeah,
pardon?
We had him on just a couple of weeks ago as a kind of a introduction into what we were planning on having tonight with Captain May, but you so graciously stepped forward to take it to take on all of the duty there.
Well, as I understand it, he went into the hospital recently with some breathing difficulties. He's suffering from Lou Gehrig's disease. It's very tragic because he's a very brilliant man, and he's done a tremendous patriotic service to this country.
Well, before you go on too far into this, we might want to explain a little bit more on what Captain May has, the history of what he's doing a little bit in Ghost Troop 2. Before,
sure.
Okay, would you like to? Okay.
Yes. Well, taking it from scratch, and incidentally, people can get full details by going to the website I've created at www.americafirstbooks.com, and that's spelled out the way it sounds, americafirstbooks.com, and just go to the Captain May archive, and from there, in addition to archiving his articles, I provide links to other websites. For example, Patty Woodard, who does a heroic job as a coordinator for a Portland activist, also maintains a website for Captain May.
And for the Ghost Troop, too.
Yes, and Ghost Troop, and she's a great moderator for the discussion boards. And she's done very heroic work as well. But in any event, if I leave anything out, there's certainly quite a lot of ground that I'm just simply not able to cover in the time that we have this evening. I would heartily advise your listeners go to that website and start reading Captain May's articles. But to give an overview, Captain May explains that the what he calls Bob Cup, or the Battle of Baghdad cover-up, was certainly a very important starting point for him. And he had served in intelligence and trained to be fluent in Russian, and was very disturbed when he found out that during the latter part of the advance on Baghdad, that in fact there had been a four-day battle in Baghdad, particularly centered around the Baghdad airport, in which the Republican Guard and the Saddam Fedayeen had successfully counterattacked. Apparently after about 6 hours of combat, the American forces were close to running out of ammunition and had to pull back. And, of course, the disturbing part is, and I'll get to that in a second, is apparently the Bush administration decided to stage a massive cover-up with the story of Jessica Lynch. Here you had this woman soldier who was traveling in a vehicle that crashed, and she was knocked unconscious, and she did not fire rounds at the enemy, as claimed in the story that was cooked up, but she was taken captive by the Iraqis, who actually ended up treating her well, thinking she'd be valuable as a prisoner, and then later decided just to, for goodwill, to turn her over. And all kinds of fabrications were made. The media, national media, used her story as a major distraction. Well, what was the distraction all about? Well, apparently, there were many hundreds of soldiers, and it's also believed Marines, who were killed in action in heavy street fighting in Baghdad. And some of the most fierce fighting took place at the Baghdad airport. And according to many sources that Captain May came across through his intelligence contacts, the U.S. exploded at least one neutron weapon. The idea is that the U.S. forces could button up inside their armored vehicles, and then once the weapon went off, the enhanced radiation would tend to fry and kill off the Iraqi counterattack force, and apparently did that fairly successfully. However, people were seen hauling away dirt and bringing in dirt to the site, which apparently was contaminated by the radiation. And also the cancer rates have apparently been very high in that area.
Would anybody have survived, though, that was in there?
Nobody's heard, because it's about what happened or the extent to which U.S. forces that were buttoned up inside their armored vehicles, if they took any extra casualties. Of course, we have other issues involved with depleted uranium, where the U.S. government has been very callous about radiation casualties of all kinds. And in fact, there are hundreds of thousands, several hundred thousand veterans of both Gulf War I and II who are now on permanent disability. With the VA, it's believed to be largely due to depleted uranium exposure. So it's doubtful that we would be given accurate information on who may have suffered from enhanced radiation as a result of that event.
I can't even imagine them living through that, but anyways.
Well, Captain May said that he went to, I believe it's Fort Stewart, Georgia, the home of the cavalry unit, armored cavalry unit, that was engaged in the, took some of the worst beating in the airport incident, and a chaplain there verified, as well as some surviving next of kin. In fact, a huge portion of that unit got wiped out. They sustained heavy casualties. This had not been reported in national media. And this chaplain also threatened him. If you read the articles by Captain May, he names this individual as well as others. So he provides tremendous detail. And basically suggested that, you know, bad things, like he might even get killed if he were to open his mouth about these kinds of things. Well, Captain May took an officer's oath to protect and defend the Constitution, and this definitely jarred him into action, feeling that something was very, very wrong with the informational policies of the Bush administration and the reasons for why America had gone to war. Originally, he had thought that, you know, the cover story about 9/11, that, yeah, there are these, you know, basically the way the national media has programmed it into Americans through subliminal conditioning. You have these big bad Arabs who hijack planes with box cutters, and unless people start putting on thinking caps, they're inclined to sort of swallow that superficially. Now, there was a Marine Captain Cross, I believe is his name, who was located a few blocks from the World Trade Center towers when they came down. He was apparently a next major influence in Captain May's awakening. And he claimed that you could feel explosions and shaking of buildings completely unrelated to the aircraft impacts that told him that this was something more than the official cover story about 9/11. And he knew that the buildings were brought down through controlled demolition. So this really apparently lit up a lot of light bulbs in Captain May's brain. And then another catalytic event was the Madrid bombing, which took place basically in March 2004. There had been an alert out that a suitcase nuke had fallen into the hands of Al-Qaeda. Announcement, there wasn't a question of if, but when a city would get nuked here in America. And at that point, with the bombing, Captain May began to think about how back in 2003 he had run an op-ed piece called Don't Laugh at Duct Tape That Saves Lives, where he argued that the Houston area was unquestionably a top terror target, since it had the nation's fourth most populous city, the home of the Johnson Space Center and the declared hometown of the Bush family, and also the nation's largest chemical district. You know, once a person learns how to think kinky, the way criminals at senior levels and traitors may begin to think, for example, arsonists are most likely to torch their own homes. And so it would be logical for senior people in the Bush administration to carry out an attack in their hometown, for example, in the Texas City area. Also, there's been a weird parallelism. For example, explosives were found inside the Murrah building in the earliest news reports. The explosive power from the so-called fertilizer bomb in McVeigh's truck was not enough when traveling through the air to shear off a third of the Murrah building in Oklahoma City. So we have the parallelism of Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Then with 9/11, we have New York, New York. So you can see a kind of parallelism with Texas City, Texas. Also, being a very sharp intelligence officer, Captain May is very savvy to the numerological significance of various number patterns. Apparently, the if we want to call Illuminatist or Jewish supremacist or whatever we want to call them, Kabbalist, they like numbers like 11 and repeated numbers. For example, Skull and Bones, their numbers 3, 2, 2, multiples of 11, 3s, 9s. And you can actually, a lot of their dates have spooky coincidences to these numerical patterns. And I have archived many articles that go into this in depth. So Captain May made a prediction that it's likely that Texas City would get hit in late March, early February 2004. And sure enough, he put out some alerts, and a bomb did go off. So that seemed to, of course you might ask, it wasn't a nuke, but it was a bomb. And a number of indicators suggested to him that maybe this was an aborted strike, that he had actually gone to the FBI and individuals in the lower echelons, initially seemed receptive, but he found that actually as he went up chain of command, that actually they reacted very negatively towards him. In fact, one agent threatened him to if he didn't keep his mouth shut. So, but nevertheless, there was an underground of policemen in the Houston area and others who were supportive of Captain May, and they were able to get the alert out, and he felt that that probably helped to thwart a full-blown attack that may have involved a nuke.
Was that the one that he was calling in from the phone, and you could hear he was reporting as it was going on, or was that?
Well, actually, there have been some repeated attempts.
Okay.
And that was actually, so this is 2004.
Okay.
That was actually in July of 2005.
Okay, right.
Actually, this first situation, it was on March 30th, the British Petroleum Refinery in Texas City experienced a major explosion. It came within 24 miles and 24 hours of Captain May's target prediction. Now, gasoline futures in the stock market jumped to historic highs, and a BP spokesman said that the cause of the fire did not appear to be intentionally caused, but intelligence insiders didn't believe this story. And according to Captain May, he said his local police contacts told him that the FBI went down and shut down the scene for next week with Homeland Security and would not let anyone close. Anyway, one theory is why they didn't use a... If in fact this had been an aborted false flag nuke operation, one of May's theories for why it may have been an abort is what he calls a cockroach theory. And that is when Ghost Troop shines a public spotlight on a potential target, potential conspirators get very nervous, like exposed cockroaches. Furthermore, insiders don't know who may be tipping off Captain May. Maybe he's got some high-level contacts with the CIA or FBI or whatever, so maybe there could be an internal turf battle. And that could cause people to back off. And we have to realize that this is just incredibly criminal and treasonous. That can make insiders nervous as well. Now, one possible motive for hitting the British Petroleum Refinery is the fact that BP self-matures below $300 million, so they would need to have something really major. Apparently, it's one of the most contaminated sites in the country. Apparently, it's a functionally obsolescent. You know, it's been decades since most refineries in America have been replaced. And so, furthermore, in more recent articles, Captain Mays talked about how one way to probably damage Ron Paul, since this is in his district, is to have repeated incidents go off. So there are lots of circumstantial, speculative indicators. Like I said, one of the, in a way, this is thankless work because it's hard to prove any of this stuff totally unless we get some insider to come forth with a confession or we get internal government documents. But nevertheless, with so much circumstantial evidence floating around, we can't afford not to be shining spotlights of potential cockroaches because we can't afford to see tens, if not hundreds of thousands of Americans die in an actual nuclear strike, which, of course, has been threatened by the head of Homeland Security and others as being a very real possibility.
And well, isn't that also because they were also having drills taking place on 9/11 and at Oklahoma City? And
well, then that's another part of the whole picture, and I'm glad you brought that up. According to Webster Tarpley, there are 25 different military exercises taking place during 9/11. And generally, the pattern has been that there are military drills taking place. In fact, Webster Tarpley points out that it's essential for conspirators to have military drills taking place so that they can then exert control over the situation. In other words, during a drill, you have a command center, you have cognizance of military units, and so the people who, at the very top, who may be running a false flag operation, can then insert into the drill the instructions that they need to go to different military units so that you don't have any units acting independently or in an unpredictable way. Also, since 99.99% of your military personnel just would find it too incredible to believe that their senior commanders would pull off a false flag event, the top people can say, hey, isn't this an interesting coincidence? We were here preparing for this nasty thing that happened. Sure enough, it happened. And doesn't this just show how wonderful we are that we tried to be prepared in the first place? And most people would buy that superficial story. Also, the government likes to make itself look good. So if a live event goes off and they it's coming after they've got up to full running speed with an exercise, then it makes the government look like they're actually doing something useful for a living, to look like heroes coming in to help create the mess, and they think the public is too stupid and gullible to actually suspect that high-level people in the government may have actually pulled off the disaster to begin with as part of a false flag operation.
Bill, if I could interject here, this
yes,
is Eric
sir.
Carlstrom. I recall the interview we had with Captain Eric May quite well. He was extremely intelligent and had a tremendous amount of information. Obviously, a very impressive guy and a tremendous courage and patriotism. And I remember the analogy that he used when he talked about these drills. And I guess he himself is a bit of a karate expert, and he says it's like if you karate instructor, and I guess he's a black belt, would go through the motions and then stop short with his right hand, 1 inch from your Adam's apple. That would be the drill, and it would be quite easy then if that instructor decided to go the extra inch to take you out. So going, it was a very graphic analogy of how these drills give a perfect setup
right,
for the operation themselves.
Exactly.
And also, historically, a lot of the wars that we've gone into have been from these false flag events.
That's right. In fact, I discussed that. The controversy papers that I linked to at the website, it goes into the whole history of, you can go back to the spot resolutions that Abraham Lincoln, as a senator, or actually as a congressman from Illinois, freshman congressman, raised an issue with involving whether or not that helped start the Mexican-American War. Were Americans really inside a border zone or not in disputed territory? Then you had the deception involving Fort Sumter, where Lincoln misled Confederate commissioners about his intention of whether or not he'd resupply Fort Sumter. I think today most researchers believe that the explosion inside the battleship Maine that started the Spanish-American War was due to internal causes and not due to any Spanish sabotage. And you can go on and on and on. Operation Gladio involving false flag communist events in Italy to try to discredit the communists in more recent time and so on. So, yes, in fact, it's such a pattern that one might think it would be strange if
they weren't, there wasn't one,
administration didn't try a false flag event. What's weird is not trying a false flag event, giving the historic patterns, not conducting one. Incidentally, another point that Captain May has made is that, ultimately this is an information war as much as it's a false flag war. It's important to condition audiences to expect the possibility of a terror strike to magnify its impact in their mind. In fact, he believes, as I do, that the highest level conspirators also have tremendous influence over Hollywood. They work hand in hand. And there are movies like Independence Day that have scenarios involving a fight against outsiders or blowing up iconic buildings in America and a fighter pilot president, that, and even a nuclear explosion in the Houston area, that on a subliminal level prepare Americans to think about terror as a valid construct. And so terrorist exercises also condition the military to think that terrorism is a real threat and not possibly a false front where the Mossad and CIA have largely created what Captain May refers to as al-CIA duh, instead of Al-Qaeda. So that's certainly another important element. Of course, he also points out that when we expose these mechanizations, it really fouls up their scenario and causes them to back off. So there's quite a lot that common citizens can do by monitoring intelligence indicators and trying to expose these people.
Again, I would just like to emphasize that I was so impressed with Captain May's intelligence. I mean, we're dealing with a tremendous mind here. In order to, I guess, play chess with these highest level conspirators, as you call them, people can do what they can do, but it sure helps to have somebody like Captain May on your team because he has such a broad understanding of how the system works. And I guess the rest of us have to educate ourselves as rapidly as we can.
Well, that's one reason why I wanted to spend extra time writing articles for the Lone Star Iconoclast on my own and also archiving his articles to help preserve it for members of the general public, because we need everybody we can get to come aboard with the Ghost Troop. The Ghost Troop is pretty open in its membership in terms of it's not really promoting a particular ideological background except a patriotic sentiment towards supporting and defending the Constitution of the United States. And we definitely need to attract very bright, idealistic people who particularly a need for people who are willing to follow current events and look for intelligence indicators and try to put things together, as Captain May has. He's shown a real talent for following current events and extracting from details suggestive patterns that are worth activist efforts.
Yeah, we've had on this very interesting Truth Quest radio show, we've had some great guests, and one of them was a systems analyst. They seem to have a special knack for looking at the big picture and finding the patterns there, not losing the details, but plugging the details into the larger pattern, and that's a very, very valuable kind of intelligence right now, I believe.
Right. Actually, I have come to the party here with a somewhat different focus than Captain May. Although I feel that his approach is extremely valuable, I like to compare it to looking at a predator-counter-predator model. For example, in a publication, they were talking about how political correctness in America, an opinion piece, talked about how one reason why the forces of political correctness are so out of control are because it's like predators in an ecology model. They're running amok because there's an absence of counter-predators to keep them in check.
Yeah, excellent.
And, in fact...
That works for me.
Yes, and in so many issues, it's not a question of right or wrong. In terms of factual verification or scientific rationality, what the conspirators are up to in terms of false flag events is just totally criminal. They're cover stories. Once you begin to look at 9/11, it's just so totally absurd that... the planes could bring down these reinforced towers, and the absurdity of Larry Silverstein talking about pulling Building 7 and then watching that thing come down hours after the main World Trade Center towers came down. I mean, I could go on and on, but once you begin to look at it critically, the cover story is just absolutely ridiculous of just about everything connected with that. One question is, how can they get away with it? In other words, why is it that people haven't more aggressively tried to indict FBI agents who appear to have been involved in cover-up operations involving removing evidence from the site of 9/11 or putting Larry Silverstein for a grand jury? Why have citizens been so passive? And I'm really asking a question, why is it that they can't be more effective counter-predators? What have we lost on a broader social and political and ideological level that so many Americans have become so dumbed down and so anemic? So before I became aware of Captain May, I was focusing on trying to address the weaknesses of the counter-predators on a lot of these more broader social and political issues. In fact, at my website, AmericaFirstBooks.com, I have a 30-question quiz titled, Have You Been Brainwashed? Which I examine quite a few issues from many different perspectives, ranging from religion to money and credit. So I think that Americans have actually been very seriously brainwashed over a very long period of time, going back even as far back as what libertarians today now call the war against Southern independence. And I think that's an important side of the equation, because we need to strengthen Americans at the grassroots. They need to become more sophisticated. They need to de-brainwash themselves. And once the counter-predators get stronger, then we'll stand a greater chance of keeping the predators under control. However, that having been said, I have to emphasize that, yes, we also have to deal directly with the predators. We have to deal directly, you know, the devil's often in the details. We have to deal with the nitty-gritty of watching them like hawks, reacting to the moves. That's also critically important. That, of course, has been a role that Captain May has done incredibly well.
Bill, of course, this jumps, leaps right into the next question that I've been wanting to ask since you mentioned that Mossad and elements of the CIA were behind 9-1-1, and that is, and then you mentioned things like Kabbalist, Jewish, I'm trying to find the words that you used, Jewish supremacists, Illuminatus, Kabbalists.
Right.
So you've somewhat identified the enemy, and of course it's an axiom in the military that to know your enemy. So who is our enemy? I hear different views on this, and I'd just like you, if you could flesh this out a little bit.
All right. Well, I pride myself on trying to give very, very straight answers.
I know that's a loaded question, and if it's too loaded, let me know.
You know, part of the enemy is, you know, I was a stockbroker for 10 years, and there's a concept called regression to the mean, where you find that over the long run, companies and industries tend to revert back to historical norms of various types of performance patterns, whether it's turnover inventory or return on equity or the length of their business cycles or the length of their the entrepreneurial side of going from new product development into marketing. And so part of the art of being an intelligent investor is to understand what is considered normal over the long-term period and look for abnormalities to discover companies or industries are significantly undervalued, and then let time work in your advantage to where they regress back to the mean. And believe me, having seen the bubble market of the late 90s, it was amazing to me, all the people who were supposedly very intelligent who thought that valuing internet stocks based on clicks and telecom companies based on miles of fiber optic cable as metrics could somehow be valid, when that's complete foolishness from a long-term viewpoint. And sure enough, eventually the market's correct and those people lost a lot of money. So what I'm getting at, starting out is I think it's good to build a model of what's normal for human societies, which gets back to my focus on traditional American conservative values, and then look at how societies get distorted over time and who can distort them. And so actually I take some very long-term macro views. I think that different human groups have evolved around the planet to have very different mental and cultural characteristics. The peoples of Northern Europe have evolved where they were in a tribal society with tribal deities, with a natural religious approach, and with a relatively large middle class, and with a high degree of individual self-sufficiency relative to other societies around the planet. So I think that emotionally what a lot of, at least Americans in the dwindling white middle class, I think what they instinctively want are...
Oops.
is basically a replication of something similar to what existed in Iceland, of a free society with a high degree of individual rights, a homogeneous society, and where you have a relatively large middle class of armed freemen and a relatively small aristocracy and a small underclass. I think that's my model of what I think most white middle class Americans want deep down inside. But that's, we have other groups that seek special privilege that are pushing us in very different directions. They're pushing us towards multiracialism. They're pushing us towards globalism, open borders, being flooded, taken over by other people. They're pushing us towards a society that's driven by finance rather than a focus on creating real and useful productive things. So then the next intelligent question is, who are these distorters who are trying to distort society away from the norms, and what are their characteristics, and why do they behave the way they do? And so I think that there are a lot of different models to try to look at that, but certainly when we look back in American history, I think that a beneficial part of the colonial period is people came over from Europe, and a lot of their societies had become very stratified with a class system, and in the wilderness, they were able to reinvent themselves and rediscover a high level of individual freedom that had existed in an earlier prehistoric period, and they liked that. But at the same time, there were other influences. They had abandoned their indigenous religion when they became Christianized in the late Middle Ages, so that was a distorting influence. Then later, you have alien groups with alien values who came into their cities and began to take over their financial institutions and promote an agenda very different than what they are comfortable with in terms of their norms. So I'm being a little bit abstract, but I think it's important to kind of lay that as a groundwork, because we have to understand two things. We have to understand the characteristics of the people we're talking about, and I think America is historically, I mean, it was started as a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant country. It was the white middle class that laid the background. They were basically Northern European descent, a combination of Nordic and Celtic peoples, and I think we have to understand who they are and how they feel. And then when we talk about other groups, certainly one of the most powerful groups have been the, for example, with the attack on the USS Liberty and books like They Dare to Speak Out by Congressman Paul Finley, or the ability, according to Michael Collins Piper, and They Dare to Speak Out, of Mossad to carry on assassination of a U.S. president in broad daylight. You have a Jewish elite that has amassed extraordinary power, and so we have to ask, how they've been able to operate in usually in a highly urban environment to accumulate so much power. What are their tactics? By having lived in New York City for 10 years, I would say that what amazed me is my impression of the Jewish community is that, each culture and society has a different style that's skewed in a different direction, and they impressed me as being more like a CIA in search of a country than any other group that I encountered there in terms of basic values. And so there, we could definitely spend a lot of time discussing their characteristics, but I would look at the issue of cultures and peoples in conflict. I've painted some very broad brushstrokes here. I guess my question back to you is what have I left dangling here from your viewpoint?
Oh, I think it's a very good answer, and I've been reading some Eustace Mullins lately, the guy who wrote the book called The Federal Reserve Conspiracy.
Right, I'm familiar with Eustace. I've met with him and spoke with him a number of times.
Yeah, very, very impressive, and he certainly seems to think that the 9-1-1 and the globalist agenda and whatnot, he lays that pretty much at the doorstep of the Zionists. And not only that, but also World War One and World War Two and the Civil War, for crying out loud, and the Great Depression, et cetera. So for him, it's kind of he's figured it out in his mind, and that's where he lays the blame. This is an idea that anybody who says something like that would automatically be charged as being an anti-Semite. But But as you start reading into it, you realize that Zionism is a political movement and quite different from, say, Orthodox Judaism. And you can be, and as Eustace says, what we're dealing with is a criminal syndicate. It's not as if it's a religious faith. We're dealing with this criminal group. I'm starting to see the world in a little bit like Eustace sees it. I don't know if that sounds accurate to you or not.
Well, I'd like to qualify this. I think that the presence of a Jewish elite is both a cause and an effect. And I think it's useful to, my website, I talk about how ideologies can be understood in terms of dualities we understand from scientific disciplines. You have sort of the environmental versus genetic viewpoint and management science, centralized versus decentralized. And then another duality I look at is what I call mutualism, very similar to republicanism, versus parasitism, which is very similar to criminality and sociobiology. And, looking at a sort of a learning or environmental perspective, and some other perspectives, we can understand a lot of conflict that takes place between different white groups without looking at the Jewish presence. In other words, during the Viking era, there's a certain amount of instinctive aggression and instinctive tribalistic conflict that takes place among most human societies, even when the Jewish people aren't a factor. I mean, the Scottish clans were fighting each other before the Jews showed up, and before the Jews were a factor in Old Ireland, you had Vikings who showed up, and often in about half the Viking battles, they would team up with one Irish chieftain to raid another Irish chieftain and fighting over cattle or whatever. So I think that we have to understand the problems of, there's certainly baseline human conflicts that take place both in terms of class warfare and racial conflict that take place across human societies, and even when the Jews are not a factor. So then the question is, when Jews have moved into societies, what has the effect been? And generally what has happened is, as they have, Jews are unique in that most human societies require their own territory. And they have their own diversified population group, where you have farmers and you have a craftsman, and you have sort of the military and other functional areas. Often they overlap each other. For example, in the Nordic societies, you had the free farmers who also were the warriors, whereas in Asiatic societies, they're much more pyramidal, where the warriors would be a distinct class, and you have a large peasant, miserable masses class. But the point I'm leading up to is the Jews are unique in that for over a 3,000-year period, since ancient times, they've always been known as a highly urbanized people. So the view in the Old Testament, they're pastoral people, is, I think that's actually very questionable. It's more likely that they were always targeted by preference, occupations involving brokerage and trade and financial manipulation. And existed, were always known through recorded history by independent sources as existing in little colonies throughout the ancient world. In fact, an ancient Roman writer called them the most criminal of all races, because they were also known since ancient times of dominating the slave trades and being a major presence in organized crime, as they had been. For example, books like Superbob by Gus Russo point out that the mafia in America has been about 50% Jewish and 25% Italian and 25% other. And
boy, that's a number I've never seen or heard before.
Yeah, that's in Superbob by Gus Russo about Las Vegas and the rise of... one should also read Final Judgment by Michael Collins Piper. We talked about Mayor Lansky, who was the Jewish crime boss.
Yeah, I'm aware of him, right.
Yeah. But anyway, it's known throughout Europe that the most of the underworld slang comes from Yiddish. So, Jews have always been kind of in a hybrid between the shadowy side and the legitimate side, reflecting a complex phenomenon to various peoples. But I think the impact has been that The Jews have always been a racially mixed people. I mean, they've preserved their inheritance through the mother's side. To be Jewish, you have to have a Jewish mother. And there's some research that helps to preserve characteristics. But they've, you know, absorbed some characteristics from a few people here and there that they've intermarried with. But they've always been a people who have been known to are aggressively very verbal or prone towards speculative professions and very underrepresented in professions such as what a Henry Ford or Andrew Carnegie would be excel at. It involves a certain ability, a focus on, like a farmer of, you know, a very patient, long-suffering assemblage of productive factors and a very sort of a scientific, technological mindset. That's been different than their temperamental traits. Their temperamental traits have tended to be towards quick gain and exploiting their superior social organization. The Jews are very, very organized.
Well, you know, I can understand that to a point, but what I'm seeing, criminality does not remain in any particular ethnicity or gender or anything of that sort. And what I'm viewing that's going on right now is it seems to be just corruption is across the board. And unless and anything like 9/11 had to have had a lot of complicity or help from all groups or gangs of you name it. And I can't see how it can just be one group, because I don't think they may be very powerful, but I don't see how they're all powerful.
Right. Well, I would say that you're hitting on an important point, and that is there are different lines of analysis that I think are valid. There's also the libertarian line of analysis that, you know, absolute power corrupts absolutely, and as a government becomes more imperial, it tends to foster more corruption at the top because it's more centralized. And in fact, the power structure has become increasingly more centralized ever since the war against Southern independence, which you know, others conventionally call the Civil War. Up until the war against Southern independence, government was less than 5 to 10% of GDP. Ever since states' rights were crushed, we've seen a steady trend towards unlimited government, federal government. And now government, all government, local, city, state, et cetera, is about 50% of GDP in terms of taxation, in terms of its share of the economy. These are very rough figures. But certainly you can apply a libertarian analysis, which ignores ethnicity, or what I call an anarcho-libertarian analysis, such as what the folks at the Mises Institute at Mises.org like to apply. And you can explain a lot of corruption due to tremendous centralization in America. However, I think that there are also some cultural genetic factors. For example, John DeNugent, who writes for the Barn Review, has discussed research on psychopaths, where within the white-Gentile gene pool, according to research by Dr. Linda Smealy, about 5% of the 4 to 5% are genetically based psychopaths. And in fact, their brains respond differently to sadistic stimuli compared to normal people. Different parts of the brain light up. And there's considerable evidence. There's a book called American Values Decline that I carry as an e-book that does studies where there is evidence that there is a genetic basis. It's not a complete correlation. I don't know what the exact correlation coefficient would be, but there is a certain relationship between genetics and criminality, if we particularly define that as psychopathology. So there seems to be anecdotal level, it would be interesting to test for this, but we know that different racial groups, for example, blacks, have different psychopathology rates or different rates of sociopaths and psychopaths compared to whites. So these traits with a hereditary basis seem to be distributed differently within different gene pools. So there's a possibility that there could be a higher concentration among Jewish people, although I'm not claiming that all Jews are psychopaths or sociopaths. I'm just suggesting that there's a possibility that they could have a much higher concentration within their inbred group. So getting back to the interplay I think a lot of people believe that what happens when a highly cohesive group comes in is, first off, one of the rules of Right Wing 101 is that people tend to recreate the environment around them so it suits their characteristics. So, for example, when beavers that like to build beaver dams enter a marsh, the marsh begins to take on beaver characteristics. In other words, dams start happening. Same with ants. Ants are like anthills. So when ants enter an area of flat earth, next thing you know, that area begins to take on ant characteristics of anthills. Now, the Jews have always historically been people heavily geared towards intrigue, towards occupations that involve speculation, and towards brokerage. And they've always been a racially mixed people. So what tends to happen, amazingly enough, when you study Jewish history, is when they enter a homogeneous Northern European society or some other society, is over time, those societies tend to take on, as the Jews become more powerful, take on Jewish characteristics. They become more Byzantine in their laws. They become more geared towards intrigue. They become more racially mixed, and they become more geared towards financial speculation as opposed to the Henry Ford approach, which is a focus on creating organizations that produce technologically advanced products. That seems to be the historical pattern. A lot of it is basically biological. You can understand it from how different biological groups tend to become biologically imprinted based on the evolutionary environment that they have evolved in on a Darwinian level. So to summarize, there's sort of a cause and effect thing where I think the original problems in America, the fractures, came from the fact that the American government became increasingly more centralized in the early 1800s, and the war against Southern independence was a great watershed that pushed us towards increasing centralization. And there was already a problem in America with different racial, with different ethnicities among white people between the Scots-Irish and the Puritan-descended New Englanders, and then the class structure, the blacks with the slavery, and then the indentured servants from the interclasses. There were already some very significant tensions within America before the war against Southern independence, and then after the catastrophic war of Southern independence, that created very serious fractures in American society. And then, almost like a disease model, like somebody who loses their resistance and then a pneumonia virus comes in and takes over, then millions of Jews flooded into New York City, and their role was to take a lot of the running sores of American society and expand upon them so that America's problems went from being difficult but solvable to being essentially unsolvable. So from a biological view of American history, the for example, the Nordic percentage of the American population, the Nordic Celtic peoples used to be 75% of the population, they've been in steady decline ever since the war against Southern independence. And, of course, the white population has been in decline ever since the mid-60s with the Immigration Reform Acts. And so you can see a biological change over time, a complete reshaping of American society. And I would say that some people think that what created America was the foundation of institutions and population created in the 19th century, and America's been in kind of a parasitic drawdown ever since. It's just winding down where its institutions and its population groups are just being sort of exploited into the ground. And so now we witness the out-of-control exploding debt, the loss of two-thirds of our industrial base, and you know, now things are, I mean, one of the explanations for the aggressive foreign policy of the war in the Middle East is to distract Americans from the fact that their economy has already been gutted over the last few decades. There's this person, Newman Fingleton, who wrote a book called In Praise of Hard Industries, where he claims that a healthy economy needs to maintain about a third of GDP in heavy industry. And that's a whole other discussion. I happen to agree with him. But America, the implication is, if America's lost 70% of its heavy industry, it's basically lost about 70% of the underpinnings of its real economy. And right now, a huge part of the U.S. economy is playing a vicious game of musical chairs with paper shuffling. And, you know, and so the powers that be know it. They know that they've exploited America too much, that they've ruined it. In fact, when I lived in New York City, there were a number of Jewish people who said, darn it, they're, you know, they ruined it. They got too greedy and they screwed it up.
So the parasites basically have killed the host. Is that what you're saying?
And what do is distract us with wars.
Eventually,
when the white middle class, which is dropping in the percentage-wise, 1.5% a year, I think, you know, in the 60s, it used to be 90%, now we're down to about 65%. With a low birth rate, you know, whites lose about 20% or 30% of the population each generation. And in 100, 200 years, whites will be wiped off the face of the earth. They've gone from one-third of the world population at the turn of the century to now 8%. And, you know, the people who are in charge of America are afraid that the white middle class that's been propagandized in any form of white self-protectiveness is evil racism, that at some point, seeing that they're on the precipice, that something's going to kick in on a very primal level, and they may rise up and go for the throats of the power elite that they think sold them out. And that scares the hell out of the power elite. So they're doing everything they can right now to try to take away our civil liberties, to turn America into a police state, and distract us with wars in the Middle East, because they're scared to death that if the dwindling white middle class ever wakes up, things are going to be very nasty for them. So they're trying a defense of just creating such a big mess and so much wreckage that they can sort of hide everything.
They're setting so many fires, there's no way to put them all out. But to go back, I like your biological metaphors there as a society and predators and counter-predators and parasites and hosts. But to kind of go back to the Zionist theme, people like Eustace Mullins talk about back in the late 1700s when Amschel Mayer Rothschild employed Adam Weishaupt to found the Illuminati, and that this organization was going to infiltrate the Freemasons, etc., and the goal of it was going to be to destroy the Goyim, that is to say non-Jews, and the plan, and they've called it by various names, Worldwide Revolutionary Movement, the Grand Plan, etc., is to destroy the family, is to destroy private property, is to take away national sovereignties, it's to take away the viability of all the institutions which basically give society coherence, so that they could then impose their dictatorial rule over the whole world, the one world government, the new world order, etc. And we've heard leaders talk about the new order and things like that. So Eustace Mullins talks about that, various other authors talk about that, and it does seem that there is a heavy Jewish component behind this New World Order that morphed into the Bolshevik Revolution and communism through Marx, that morphed into the State of Israel through the political movement of Zionism. So it would seem that this is a very, very secretive program with a specific goal in mind, and that is they want it all. Would you agree with that?
Well, I interpret things a little. Well, the answer is generally yes, but I just put a different spin and a slightly different interpretation on a lot of these things. So, for example, Israel Shahak talks about how Judaism is inherently a totalitarian religion. And I think that if you look at the Asiatic model of Asian societies, what's called Asiatic despotism, they have a social order, and this applies not just to Jews, but a lot of Asian peoples in general, what I call the guerrilla gangster social model. And the way it works is it's sort of like in guerrilla troops, the guerrilla, biggest, strongest guerrilla will dominate all the females and marginalize all the males. And in a lot of Asian societies, that's how the power elite operates, is whoever can put together a gang and using whatever tactics, tell whatever lies, whatever deception. It's kind of what Captain May was talking about, the Straussian approach of pure power, the pure Machiavellianism, which incidentally a lot of Jewish neocons have been advocating. You put together your gang, you rise to the top, and all that matters is getting to the top of the heap. And in these societies, they're very pyramidal, and in these societies, they have a very cynical attitude towards law, in which law is something that you apply with you do whatever you want with your in crowd, but you use law as a snare to keep people below you in their place. So laws tend to be very convoluted, And, of course, life at the bottom of these societies is very miserable. You have masses of slaves or masses of people who just breed and live like ants.
Bill, I'm going to have to break here for a...
Okay.
This is KHENLP 106.9 Salida, and this is Truth Quest. And our guest tonight is Bill Fox.
Yeah, please continue, Bill. This is very interesting, the power pyramidal structure you're talking about.
Well, I need to compare with Northern European society that America was founded on. It's very important I compare these two different types of societies, but I would argue that, and well, not just me, but many people who have studied racial histories, that a lot of human societies that evolve in these pyramidal Asian societies are programmed innately towards monopolistic tactics. It's like a gorilla. I mean, a gorilla is innately programmed to monopolize the harem and marginalize weaker males and grab all the females for himself. A gorilla does not understand democracy. It's not in his genes, you know. And there are racial historians who feel that in Asian societies, frankly, a lot of humans who've evolved in that by temperament have the gorilla mentality, and they just don't, on an emotional level, understand Western concepts of democracy. In fact, in a lot of Asian societies, things are a little bit inverted compared to American societies. For example, we glorify individualism in the West, whereas in certain Asian societies, individualism is viewed as a sign of immaturity. And maturity is considered being the ability to sacrifice yourself for the collective good, or what we call collectivism. In fact, I put together an e-book by Ralph Townsend called Ways That Are Dark. This was first published in 1933, The Truth About China. And he talks about the Chinese attitudes towards truth, and that is that dissimulation or telling half-truths is so common in Chinese society, at least back then, that they had no real word for lie. So the word lie didn't carry the sense of moral stigma that it carries in the West. And so, once again, huge temperamental and cultural differences. Now, having created that, I think that the Jewish people tend to fit the Asian model, the guerrilla gangster model, on a very basic instinctive level. I don't think they really, on an emotional level, comprehend individualism and our concepts of chivalrous behavior the way a lot of people do, particularly from Northern Europe. Now, let me, for a moment, discuss the Northern European model. If you look at the history, you know, in Asian society, you hear stories about the Chinese emperor who clicks his fingers and 500,000 heads roll of a defeated army. Or the ruler who decides he doesn't like somebody, so the person doesn't like, just meekly goes up and lays his head on the chopping block and gets it chopped off. You know, in the Asian societies, or the sultan who's born with his harem, so he amuses himself by watching the girls in his harem get drowned altogether, get thrown in the ocean. You know, or there was one cruel sultan I read about in Ripley's Believe It or Not who was born with his harem, so he locked them all inside a harem chamber until they died, and he liked to listen to their screams at night as they were dying. You know, so that's what you call Asiatic despotism. Now let's look at European society, particularly in Northern Europe. There the pattern is the opposite. In the history of old Sweden, when things went wrong, the people would rise up and kill their kings. The history of old Scotland, the history of old Norway, the people rise up and kill the kings, not the other way around. And furthermore, the center of gravity, if you look at Tacitus, who's the Roman writer, talked about the Agricola in Germania. Before the 30 Years' War in the 17th century, actually Germany was mostly Nordic and less Alpine. You have these different groups. You have the Celts, the Alpines, the Nordics, but the Nordics tend to be very individualistic and free-spirited. You know, Tacitus, the Roman writer, wrote, he lived sometime in the early first century AD, I believe, during that general time period, wrote about how in German society, every free German male carried a sword, was armed, carried a shield or spear. To be a man, you are armed. To be a free man, you are armed. And they owned their own land. Same thing if you read the sagas of Sweden and Norway. Yes, they had a little bit of an aristocracy. Yeah, they had some slaves. They had an underclass. But relative to Asian societies, they didn't have the masses. What characterized all those societies in Ireland and the Celtic societies and France, Sweden, and in the West, if you look at the Swiss, the Helvetii, is they had always had this huge middle class of armed freemen, and that's where the power was. And in time of war, the people who would turn out to fight, for example, in the saga literature of old Sweden and Norway and Iceland, it's not a professional mercenary class like in Asia, but it's free farmers who own their own swords and spears. And if you look at the Anglo-Saxon common law, there's a tremendous interchangeability between, for example, a sheriff can easily deputize a member, a freeman in his community to assist him in law enforcement. So you have this sense of interchangeability, whereas in the Asian societies, the law enforcers are a bunch of brutes or thugs who impose the will of the ruler upon the oppressed masses.
So this is where our militia kind of came from, was this society that had the freemen?
Exactly. Okay. In fact, the militia, they called it the folkmoot in the Scandinavian society of bands of armed freemen. It's considered normal to form your own group of armed freemen. Also, the doctrine of jury nullification. Again, the idea that a group being tried before your peers, this is very ancient. In fact, the parliamentary system goes back through pre-Christian times. In Iceland, you have the parliament planes, Thingvellir. In Norway and Sweden, they had what's called a thing. Even today, what we call a parliament is called a thing in the Anglo-Saxon culture. In fact, Thomas Jefferson wrote about the Anglo-Saxon hundreds. He felt that much of America was based on the ancient traditions of the Anglo-Saxons. In fact, who are Nordic people, Thomas Jefferson felt that way so much that he created a grammar of Anglo-Saxon and wanted it to be instructed among his fellow Americans. It's interesting. As Thomas Jefferson got older, he became more right-wing, and he began to really push the Northern European hereditary ancestry bit as he got older. There was an Icelander who referred to his people as an egalitarian people with aristocratic tendencies. And so that sense of individualism, the middle class, another thing is law. That's an important thing to talk about, the character of law. Harry Brown, who was a libertarian presidential candidate, unfortunately passed away. I used to enjoy listening to his lectures with a few reservations here and there, but he had mostly a lot of very good stuff. He wrote a great book called Why Government Doesn't Work. But he also pointed out that the Anglo-Saxon law is based on very simple principles. For example, don't trespass on another person without their permission, and do everything that you say you're going to do. It's just very, very simple principles. You don't need a lot of law books. In fact, one reason why settlers going out west to form the Lone Star Republic or in the Oregon territories creating new republics and new states during the westward expansion didn't need to have a lot of lawyers is because in the the Celtic Anglo-Saxon tradition, people are highly self-governing, highly competent on a grassroots level to take care of their own affairs, like in a New England town hall meeting. The law stems from them. There are some great stories I've learned about, for example, in a lot of mining towns in California. The miners elected their own sheriffs, elected their own government, created their own juries, they created their own law, and they governed themselves very well. There are a lot of documented cases out west. Same with other industries. And so, in fact, Dr. Ralph Ryko, who's with the Mises Institute, gives talks on classical liberalism. He said that when, I think his name is Buchanan, one of the great Russian anarchists of the 19th century, when he fled Tsarist police, Bukharin or whatever his name was, and came to San Francisco in the mid-1800s, he looked around and he said he didn't have anything to tell Americans about anarchism because Americans already lived in his concept of the ideal utopian anarchistic society. In fact, Dr. Murray Rothbard pointed out that a keystone of the American experience is that when settlers came over and settled in Pennsylvania and elsewhere, they had almost no government by European standards, and they discovered they weren't missing anything. That was a key. In fact, when Alexis de Tocqueville came to America in the 1830s, wrote Democracy in America, he said that America at that time had about the same population size as France, and he said that yet America had 30 times fewer bureaucrats than France.
I bet it's not that way anymore.
That's our problem today. That gets back to the centralization thing where we have, I can view our problems along sort of this environmental libertarian dimension of concentration of power that's independent of the Jewish influence, but then I can look at it at a biological, cultural level of the circulation of elites about how the old white Anglo-Saxon Protestant elite of the 19th century has been completely dispossessed. So we can approach this topic from many different perspectives, but getting back to de Tocqueville, he talked about how people like he encountered this man from western Tennessee who made his living shooting bears, and he became a congressman, was self-taught, and his name is Davy Crockett, and what's this democracy coming to? And he told another story about how he went to the White House, and he was very underwhelmed. He said, this is really no different than the average upper-middle-class home of a nobleman in Paris. And he went to the front door. He expected a retinue, such as what aristocrats in France would have, or nobility. And instead, Andrew Jackson opened the door, invited him in, and even asked him to sit at a table and pour tea for him. That blew his mind. Here, the head guy of the United States didn't have a retinue at the White House. I think even Thomas Jefferson was famous for taking late night strolls down Pennsylvania Avenue, and he would informally chat with people. This informality of the Americans, this sense of the American pioneer culture and American egalitarianism was very much a part of the and everything, was done on a voluntary basis. Private charities were really big, and people, it was common for the average American in a settlement to be with a volunteer fire department, be with a local volunteer militia, and everything was decentralized, but America actually did very well. I mean, if you look at the economic statistics, America enjoyed some of its strongest sustained economic growth when it had a highly decentralized free enterprise money system with often periods of deregulated gold and silver coinage. And, those bad old days actually look pretty darn good compared to the problems that we have today. So getting back to, we have to compare and contrast the whole nature of this Western society with its traditions of individual liberty and individual freedom with Asiatic despotism, and I frankly think part of the problem is that since the war against Southern independence, America started on this track towards extreme centralization of its federal government, and then we had the influence. I would say, if I were to summarize, one of the biggest problems of these elite Jews is I think the Jewish culture is so heavily geared towards intrigue that they can't prevent their worst people from rising to the top. I mean, obviously, there are a lot of Jewish people who seem to be responsible, nice, okay people, or people you meet out on the street or, as next-door neighbors and so on. But I think that, and that's certainly a lot of truth to that. I'm not trying to say that all Jews are bad and so on.
I'm not either. I'm just really trying to get at the heart of the problem, and it would seem that the City of London, Wall Street, the Federal Reserve System, which itself is a private bank, a consortium of private banks held by private bankers, that these all relate somehow to the era of the robber barons and the monopolistic form of capitalism, which we're seeing now, where you have the Walmarts of the world putting out of business small town America all across the country. And and taking over, destroying small town America.
One way I would look at it is if you're in a family or a monarchy, you're going to pass it down to your next generation. So I think it's almost like a secondary thing on your class system too, that you're passing down your occupation to your children. And so if the Rothschilds were in banking, then they're going to naturally pass it on to their children. So to say that all one race is top of the world in the monetary system, I think would be a real distortion as to what, because I'm sure there's plenty of people within that particular race that don't fit that criteria.
Right. I think that with human populations, you know, you have the bell-shaped distribution curve, and it's more a question of how it tends to be skewed one way or another. I mean, different groups are geared towards different things. As an example, my mother comes from Norway, and one thing that has often struck me about Norwegian culture, at least before a lot of changes have taken place in the post-World War II era, is how heavily geared it was traditionally towards seafaring. And, you know, often I had a grandfather who was a captain of merchant fleet, sailed around the world many times, and the whole culture, whether it's going back to the Viking era where people were buried in graves or marked out like ships, you can also see this in many places in Sweden, and the emphasis, on at one point, Norwegians with a minuscule population before World War II controlled something like a quarter of the world merchant fleet. And, their society, I mean, without going into a lot of detail here, in terms of the behaviors and attitudes, is heavily geared towards seafaring. And in contrast, Prussia was once referred to as an army in search of a country. So different societies tend to be geared towards different things, and they tend to be skewed in certain directions. And I would say that the Norwegian society has both strengths and weaknesses. I don't think that, although the Nordic peoples and Norwegians tend to be good at seafaring and things that involve adventure and technology. There's certainly a lot of technology that goes into ships and navigation. I don't think that intrigue, acting like CIA operatives, is particularly what they're famous for. You go out to Minnesota, I don't think that the Norskies out there are noted for being the slickest intriguers in the world. And in contrast, when you live in New York, which is a highly urbanized population, appreciate the fact that Jewish people have always been urban throughout recorded history, they seem to have a natural gift for anything to do with intrigue. So I would say their population is, their culture is very heavily skewed in that direction. As a consequence, I think there are fewer checks and balances, and I think that people who are extreme intriguers are more likely, who are to the point of being psychopathic, are more likely to rise to the top in that kind of society than in a society like a Nordic society, where there's an emphasis on personal valor and openness and honesty and technological adaptation, of where the theme is man versus nature, as opposed to the urban environment where the emphasis has been on man versus man and intrigue.
I think that
there's these other factors as well, pardon?
Yeah, I think that if we can flesh this out a little bit, you mentioned earlier the fact that the ruling elite or the conspiratorial elite or whatever, the Jewish supremacists or whatever we want to call them, have tremendous inroads in Hollywood. In fact, they kind of control it, as well as the press, which gives them kind of an ability to set the terms of the matrix, if we might call it that. In fact, Alan Watt has a website, Cutting Through the Matrix. And the matrix then becomes our collective perceived reality, which may have not much to do with reality itself. It's a system of kind of perpetuated myths and stories, which often distract us from what's really going on, I think. So if you have this small group that has very heavy influence in the boardrooms, in the corporate, the CEOs, the secret societies, the Hollywood, the press, you really have a small group that can wield an enormous amount of power over the larger masses. Wouldn't you say that's the case?
Right. Well, I've been frustrated dealing with some of my fellow Norwegian Americans. They're so individualistic, they find it difficult to actually have an intelligence conversation like we are about these factors, you know, with the political correctness conditioning and work together. On the other hand, when I lived in New York and I was surrounded by Jewish people, the Jewish people are much more likely to talk to each other and organize and cooperate with each other. So you have different patterns in terms of social cooperation. The I think also Jews are often raised from an early age to expect they're persecuted, and the world is hostile.
When I worked in a factory, though, they used to, men used to work together, and the women were the ones that wouldn't work together. I mean, I think you can find that in numerous different aspects. But one of the things that I'm power does not like to let go of power, and it doesn't matter where you what your background or whatever you come from, they don't have a tendency to want to pass it down to the rest of the people. And in a sense, if they become psychopaths about it, and they pass the psychopathy down to their next generations. So that they actually, if you want to get into genetics on it, you could say that that's being inbred, as opposed to just a nationality. Does that make sense?
Well, we have a lot of these. We have a lot of these things happening on a lot of different levels. I mean, even in a, you know, Northern European society where there wasn't a Jewish influence, there was a tendency, if you look at the history of Scandinavia, to begin to form a class system over time, because you have different groups that begin to coalesce and they want to protect their power positions. And so they want special privilege. I mean, that's a tendency in most human societies. And part of the American experience was the fresh start, where people could get away from the incrustations of special privilege and aristocracy. I mean, that was the essence of the class, the major focus of the classical liberalism espoused by people like Thomas Jefferson and Thomas Paine at the time of the American Revolution, is trying to get away from the special privilege and that characterized European societies. So we have all these different things happening on a lot of different levels at the same time.
We kind of like in penal institutions, they will have different gangs that get together, and they will have the, you know, they will know who is the head of each gang, and that's just a tendency of a human trait to do this. And so, those in power do the same thing on the outside as well. Does that make sense?
Well, we have one other point I'd make, though, is we have a very, actually, one interesting perspective I wanted to share is that at my website I archived an article that appeared in Mankind Quarterly by Dr. Norman Hall called Zoological Subspecies in Man. And what he claims is that if you look at different animal species like rats and moose, monkeys, they had their equivalent of races just like Homo sapiens humans. In other words, the North American reindeer or moose is, mooses are different than reindeer, but let's take both as examples, are different, differentiated from the counterparts from Asia. Just like humans, you know, the Caucasians of Europe and North Central Asia are different than Negroid or Caucasoid peoples who developed in Africa, or Australoids who developed in Australia. And so mammalian species are just as differentiated as the human version of mammals. And he said what's interesting in nature is whenever two different races within a particular mammalian species, like the Norway rat versus the brown rat, or the North American moose versus the Asian moose, come together, technically it's true they're the same species, because by definition when they mate they can produce a fertile offspring. But he said nature, they don't do that. That 99% of the time, one will either they'll violently fight each other, go to war with each other, or they'll in a very subtle way usurp each other's niches and drive the other slowly out of existence. In other words, the losers will be pushed, we're talking about moose, into more marginal grazing ground with less access to water, and they'll be slowly just sort of squeezed out of existence. What does this mean? Well, this implies that racism is instinctive in nature.
In part of nature.
In fact, there's a British anthropologist named Sir Arthur Keith who developed a theory about why this survives in humans and mammalian species, because it's actually adaptive to allow beneficial mutations to take hold over time. That it's probably more intellectually correct to say this survives because these patterns confer a survival advantage to those that have these characteristics. So point I want to make is that one of the big anomalies in America is that whites would normally feel a kind of protectiveness to survive, and they've been anesthetized, where they right now, willingly allow open borders, or they have been allowing, I think something like, 30 million whites have been replaced by 30 million Mexicans on a population basis. There are millions who still flood across the border. And this kind of segues back to my earlier discussion about we had these outrages with people at the highest levels of government, and on Wall Street are telling us outrageous lies. They're pulling these outrageous false flag events. They're pulling things like depleted uranium, genocide of our troops, putting us into these catastrophic no-win Middle Eastern entanglements. They're driving us at fast forward into further into bankruptcy, this country. And why are Americans, dwindling white middle class, why are they so anemic? Why are they so passive? Why are they so unable to band together and begin to protect their interests? And actually, I think that gets back to the animal models that Dr. Norman Hall talked about. When one animal race is in contact with the other, it tends to practice the ancient formulas: be privately right-wing among your own kind to build the cohesion, and left-wing among people in your out-group to throw them off guard. And so I think that's part of the overall pattern, is we have an alien elite in control of our national media who's even if it's subconscious, their racial instinct is to keep the dwindling white majority anesthetized while they're extremely right-wing among their own kind. So, for example, in Israel, they have the Kohanim class, which can trace its ancestry back to biblical times, and they're extremely strict about avoiding race mixing. Yet these same Jewish people who promote the Zionist State of Israel, which promotes promoting the purity of race, et cetera, go overboard to promote interracial marriage among people in the outgroup of whites here in America. I think it ultimately gets down to these animal models that you see out in nature, where you see, one of the rules of Right Wing 101 is that as the distance between groups, the cultural and racial groups, or among animal species, as it increases, the chances that they'll have a predatory or parasitic relationship increases. On the other hand, as the cultural and ethnic and racial distance decreases, they become closer, the chances increase that they'll have a mutualist or altruistic relationship with each other. So basically, what America has done is we have defied the basic rules of Right Wing 101, where by embracing the melting pot ever since, even going back to the 19th century, Americans got off on a utopian kick where they cut themselves off from their European roots, and they have pursued these philosophical abstractions where they put legalisms. For example, during the Reconstruction era, white Southerners were not allowed to vote in many states, and blacks who were formerly slaves were elevated over whites and ran the legislature. So there, an alien race was elevated over fellow whites. Well, that, from the viewpoint of the rules of Right Wing 101, that's insane. But American policy has been to often promote legalistic abstraction over biological reality. So today, we see that America apparently is paying the price. So
why do you think that they're doing that to the people? What is their point in destroying America or the economy and that sort?
Well, I think it's actually in many ways a defensive strategy. I think that, for example, members of the Jewish elite are scared to death that if they allow whites to regain their racial pride, racial consciousness. One of the rules of Right Wing 101 is that it's always better to have people of your own race and ethnic group in control of the strategic basis of power, such as banking and media, because people tend to take, when you have people of your own racial and ethnic group in charge of the strategic basis of society, remember, one of the rules is the closer people are, the more likely they're to be mutualistic and altruistic. So if you have people of your own racial and ethnic group in charge of the strategic choke points of power, like the government, military, and media and banking, it's more likely that they'll have a mutualistic and altruistic attitude towards people underneath them than a predatory or parasitic one. So many of these Jewish supremacists who hold the levers of power know this, and they're scared to death that if whites become racially conscious, that whites will rise up and throw them out of power.
There's really only about 12 to 14 million Jews in the world. And so to think that they have managed to succeed to make themselves the dominant power race is really remarkable to me.
It is remarkable. But I would say actually it's remarkable for two reasons. One is they've had a unique modus operandi of living in little colonies since ancient times in highly urban areas without their own distinctive land base. And that's a real anomaly. I mean, you have some groups like the Gypsies and others that do something similar or sort of semi-nomadic, but they're really unique in that most racial and ethnic groups have their own territory and their own diversified population within that territory, and they're homogeneous within that. That's been they're tribal, and that's been the general pattern. So that's one remarkable thing. But the other thing that's remarkable is the American experience. America, when it opened up with the frontier, the emphasis became on gathering wealth, not worrying about with a melting pot philosophy of not maintaining any kind of racial or ethnic homogeneity among whites, so whites became very fragmented. And so you could claim that, and then the libertarians claim that ever since the war against Southern independence, we've had a neo-Jacobin, a leftist authoritarian government, unlike the limited republic intended by American revolutionaries. And so a lot of libertarians, if you string out the terms like Dr. Paul Craig Roberts or Gore Vidal or Harry Elmer Barnes use, you could call the U.S. government today the imperialist, neo-Jacobin, welfare, warfare state that wages perpetual war for perpetual peace, that promotes multiracialism and multiculturalism, that at one point enjoyed the vast resources of a continent. So America represented kind of this neo-Jacobin bloat bag of atomized whites that was sort of like a little, in biology you have like a little gelatin dish. When you want to grow a bacterial culture, you put them in, the little gelatin dish that's ideal for the bacteria to grow. And America became the ideal Petri dish for a group like the Jewish people to come in and rise to the top without any class structure, without any special group of old guard that would in industry who would feel a sense of protectiveness towards the white middle class. America was every man for himself, so any group that had a tremendous sense of tribal cohesion would be able to rise to the top. It's sort of like the old saying, in the land of the blind, the man with sight is king. And so by being the most dynamic and cohesive ethnic group in America, the Jewish people were able to parlay that towards tremendous success. But that's an anomaly. There haven't been many societies in American history that have been as wide open and been as fragmented and so rich in natural resources where people really wouldn't care about maintaining ethnic solidarity as America. America was a very special historical situation involving, high adrenaline greed for land and just a very unusual historical factors. But that's coming to an end, and I think that the world will go back towards nationalism, especially after the U.S. is likely to undergo major economic collapse and retrenchment.
Well, you really studied a lot of history and background there, but I'd kind of like to bring it back a little bit to what we started out when I interrupted you on the drill and
sure.
And what your participation was in the Portland Noble Resolve and Top Off.
Sure.
I agree, Bill. Thanks very much for that very wide-ranging analysis. I'm going to enjoy listening to this program again because there was a lot in there that I hadn't considered before, so thank you. But I agree with Melody. I'd like to get back to the Portland situation.
Right. I'll just add that on my website, if people want to read through my commentary on my 30-question Have You Been Brainwashed quiz, I go into a lot of this stuff. I also have extended essays on the dualities of environmental versus genetic, centralized versus decentralized, and mutualism versus parasitism, where I really lay all this stuff out. So if people listening to this feel they missed something or really want to see it in front of them in more detail, then just go to AmericaFirstBooks.com and look at my essays, and they'll pretty much get it. or the extent of my knowledge. I like the saying by Socrates, considered the wisest of all Greeks, that if I know anything, it's that I know nothing. And so this is the extent of my knowledge, I should modestly put it. But anyway, getting back to top off, a noble resolve and top off, I felt that, yes, we do have to shine a flashlight to deal with potential cockroaches, so the least I could do was to drive down from Portland to Salem, Oregon, and visit the National Guard headquarters. And what was interesting about that exercise is a couple months before, we were told by multiple media that the exercise would entertain some kind of man-made disaster. And what was disturbing is that Oregon Congressman Peter DeFazio had asked to be briefed on this presidential directive, NSPD 51, that came out in May 2007, addressing continuity of government in the event of massive emergency, which included secret annexes, which were with pertinent documents. And what was disturbing is Oregon Representative Peter DeFazio, who was a member of the U.S. Congressional Committee on Homeland Security, made a formal written request to review these secret annexes, and he was twice denied by the White House. That was not comforting. Also, Vice President Cheney and Homeland Security Director Michael Chertoff and former Senator Rick Santorum had all warned of a new 9/11 attack in the summer without giving evidence of support. Chertoff based his prediction on a so-called gut feeling. So there were some other factors, but these were disturbing enough. So when I visited the National Guard headquarters, the reaction was, what do you mean? Who says that we're going to have a man-made disaster like a nuke, a 10-kiloton nuke, which actually been described based on this Stanford and Harvard study showing a radiation dispersal pattern spreading out over downtown Portland? They said, nope, for this exercise going from August 20th to 24th, where we have a natural disaster involving Mount Hood. So nothing to worry about. Well, I think Captain May's reaction is he had been given a lot of different responses from different folks, including the original man-made disaster, terrorist-based disaster. So that certainly sounded real fishy. I think Captain May believed that with a lot of the heat that was generated by Ghost Troop and other Internet activists, that the government decided to back off and redo their scenario. Of course, another thing that was fishy is that if one looked at the original directives of military commands, the exercises were supposed to spiral up from the March-April timeframe through the August 20th and 24th, culminating with top-off in October, mid-October with a 10-kiloton or something similar radiation scenario. So how are you spiraling up when you start out with a man-made disaster and then suddenly that disappears down the memory hole come August, and then you're back live with a nuke disaster in October? That doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. But apart from chuckling to myself a little bit in the command headquarters, as on my way out, I noticed a picture on the wall of the damage to the Pentagon on 9/11. So I commented this some officers standing next to me and a public affairs lady said, "Isn't it interesting that supposedly a hijacked aircraft with a thin metal sheet nose could punch its way through three concrete reinforced quarters of the Pentagon and leave a large exit hole. Seems to me it would crumple, and the only thing that could do that would be something like a depleted uranium penetrator, not something I would expect some Arab hijackers to be able to get their hands on." So I was greeted with stony silence after that comment. The people there had promised me that they would send me photos of the interior of the control room, and a few days later they did not get back to me. They did not apply, so I guess they didn't particularly, they weren't doing handsprings and joy over some of the insightfulness that I shared with them, I suppose, or else they're paranoid, whatever. But anyway, moving along to Top Off. Top Off was much scarier than Noble Resolve coming in mid-October because, for one thing, the exercise play envisioned people finding out what the scenario, the events would be in real time while the exercise was going on. Well, certainly someone could see a lot of maneuver room for a false flag operation where people don't even have to provide a schedule in advance of what the event's going to be. They can just spring it on them. Also, and that involved roughly 15,000 people. It was the largest civil defense exercise, apparently, in American history. So, you know, the mother of all civil defense exercises, to paraphrase one of Saddam Hussein's satirized quotes. So that would seem to be a very fertile environment. That plus a scenario involving a possible 10-kiloton nuke and a radiation dispersal device downtown Portland, plus a scenario similar for Phoenix, plus one for Guam. Given that these false flag exercises tend to dovetail with military exercises, that seemed to be a very fertile climate for a real false flag event, particularly given that the Bush administration had been making indications that it's spoiling for a fight to go to war with Iran. So the way that wrapped up was quite interesting. Vladimir Putin happened to go to Tehran during the first couple days of that exercise and pledged support for Iran if it were attacked. And in an article that I wrote for the Lone Star Iconoclast, I surmised that that may have been a key factor, as well as internet activism, in possibly calling off a real scenario. Also, it's interesting that Michael Chernoff visited Portland, and believe me, we didn't view that as a positive indicator that we wouldn't have a false flag attack. He visited Portland, but interestingly enough, some police guard dogs alerted three times to explosive residue in a car in a hotel in the Lloyd Center where Chernoff was scheduled to stay. And, you know, I speculated that maybe, well, actually Captain May had some insight. He thought that if, in fact, they had a bomb, because, see, remember, radiation dispersal device means they take a lot of plutonium and they use a conventional bomb to disperse it rather than a fusion or fission process. So, once again, we're just speculating. It's possible, according to establishment sources, that that could have been due to anything. It could have been somebody out firing a weapon and they just happen to have a little residue from the pistol or something on something and the dog's alerted. Or maybe this was another abort, and the conspirators had to pull their bomb, their RDD, out of Portland, and the dogs alerted. Who knows? And once again, this is just sheer speculation on my part. Maybe there's somebody with the Portland Police Department or the FBI at a higher level who thought that they'd yank their chain a little bit and alert the dogs and scare these people a little bit and just say, hey, you know, we're not going to make it easy for you to extract this thing. We're going to create a little bit of ruckus to let you know the next go-around, maybe Portland isn't going to be so easy.
How did Portland react to a lot of this? Were they cognizant of all this going on, and did you get a lot of support?
I think the Oregonian, which is the alleged newspaper record, was pretty snide about this, basically making the ghost troop activists look like a bunch of, suspect crackpots was kind of the tone, you know. That basically the tone was, you know, how can you question a wonderful thing that's bringing so much federal money to Portland and upgrading readiness through training, blah, 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 blah. Actually, I wrote an article for the Lone Star Iconoclast, which I did my own straw poll, having been a stockbroker for 10 years in the Portland area. I had got to know a number of CEOs and head venture capitalists and other movers and shakers in the local community. And again, this was not a statistically significant scientific sampling, I grant you that, but in my straw poll of at least six people I could call, many of whom had been featured on magazine covers, et cetera, I called them up, and in my article I mentioned that, frankly, I was stunned at how naive they were, that many of them felt that they simply couldn't believe that the government would pull a false flag event. They were not aware that 9/11 might have been an inside job, and some of them were kind of paranoid. They really weren't interested in me sending a printout copy of my article after I completed it. So that actually segues back to my earlier point about counter-predators. In other words, these people who I know are worth millions of bucks. One guy has a net worth over 20 million bucks, makes a couple million bucks a year. Now, these are people who can really afford to do something significant, to act as counter-predators, and they're way out in la-la land. So what does that tell you? I think we have a lot more grassroots activism left to go before America's going to start to wake up, but we do need to find ways to reach high net worth individuals and people within the business community who are high net worth people. Let them know, hey, this is aggravation. You need the long run because you're not going to have a country anymore. You know, things are going to fall apart to the point that you're not going to have a decent business environment whatsoever. So this policy is see no evil, do no evil, and just focus on making money. That isn't going to work anymore. The things are deteriorating to the point that even you people are going to have to start getting concerned.
I'm kind of familiar with it, that they had a number of media people. I mean, it may not have been a large amount of media, but there were some very active people and groups, along with Patty Woodard and Captain May. I couldn't believe how much he got out there into the public arena doing this in his condition.
Oh, Captain May has done a fantastic job. In fact, I linked to a lot of his archived interviews of getting out in the public and giving interviews, and he's given outstanding interviews, and my hat is off to him. Incidentally, I just want to point out as a caveat to your listeners that I have viewed myself as an adjunct to Ghost Troop, that I was off of my intellectual, ideological explorations long before I got involved with Ghost Troop. Ghost Troop actually consists of people with many different ideological backgrounds. Some are leftists, some are rightists, some are anti-racists, blah, 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 blah. And I think that's good. I think that Captain May has put together a coalition of people who are mainly focused on trying to thwart false flag events, so looking for indicators, and I think that's good. I think we need many different approaches. I'm not trying to take over Ghost Troop and steer it towards a particular ideological agenda. I'm just being who I am, is basically, and I'm happy to serve as an adjunct. If there's somebody who's a little more apolitical and less ideologically oriented who can get down nitty gritty and do the kind of job that Captain May has done of focusing on the intelligence indicators and maintain a group that attracts people from all walks of life and all ideological persuasions. My attitude is, hey, that's great. You know, I'm not, like I've said earlier in this interview, I really viewed myself as an adjunct. So I don't want people to think that my views expressed in this interview necessarily reflect those views of Ghost Troop or the official views of Ghost Troop. I don't want to give that impression at all. I want to
Bill, you've outlined a strategy there that I actually hadn't thought of, and maybe you could explain it a little bit better. I think it's a very interesting one that perhaps if we educate and convince what you call high net worth people that their interests are not being served by this regime, and educate them as to what's really going on, these people might become very good counter-predators. Are there a lot of those high-net-worth people, as you call them, who are not somehow already kind of embroiled in the system or compromised by it, do you think?
You know, actually, I begin to compartmentalize that into the whole issue of how do you transform people in a society to move them towards political action on issues? I graduated from a well-known Eastern business school, and I've also felt frustration talking to a lot of my classmates who are supposed to be, you know, part of the creme de la creme, so to speak, and a lot of them are very apathetic. You know, they the conditioning has been so strong that, you know, you just focus on business, and it's taboo to bring up politics. You don't. And actually, that segues actually to another topic. You know, at my homepage at AmericanFirstBooks.com, I archive my own articles, and at the top, I inserted recently a quote from Tom Paine from Common Sense, published in 1776. The quote is, "When Republican virtue fails, slavery ensues." And Republican virtue is a concept. What I'm leading up to is I think the keynote is we have to educate business, people of all strata, the middle class, the lower class. Of course, you know, people in the lower class, the lower socioeconomic levels can still rub shoulders with people who have a lot of money. So in the long run, it kind of helps to educate everybody, and I tend to be kind of a populist or Democrat deep down inside in many ways. But I think the key issue is the Republican virtue issue, that these high net worth people, frankly, a lot of them are acting like selfish, greedy punks. I mean, if you were to take the morality of the 19th century, if you use the term Republican virtue at the time of the American Revolution, that's a term that goes back to ancient Roman writers. People would take you very seriously. And they would understand pretty much what that meant, that to have a viable Republican society, all members of society, whether it's poor people or rich people, have to have a certain amount of civic, a certain level of moral character, a certain level of intelligence, a certain commitment, a devotion to duty to make personal sacrifices for the common good. And frankly, the behavior of a lot of these people who think they're part of the business elite, whether it's on Wall Street or corporations, if we were to measure these people by the standards of the 19th century or this concept of Republican virtue that Thomas Jefferson and Thomas Paine talked about, they would be viewed as wicked men, as vile, selfish, greedy punks.
Well, we need to kind of like wind this down for the evening, so if we have any final statements here before we close the program for the night, Bill, do you have anything that you'd like to finish with here?
Well, I guess I could keep talking about the I've been thinking a lot about the Republican virtue concept. Sounds pretty archaic and sort of Victorian, but it sort of resonates with me because I think that does it also includes duty to support the survival of your own people, and I think that's I've often thought about tactics of trying to confront high net worth people. And embarrass them publicly and call them punks publicly. I mean, it's pretty chancy. A person might get sued. But frankly, you know, actually, you know, William Lynn, who's a military analyst, I linked him in my sitemap. You can find him at antiwar.com. Very brilliant man. He talks about how in insurgencies, you know, there are two tactics that people use. They fight the established order, but also they punish people in their own ranks. So, for example, local police are often some of the most dangerous enemies of insurgents. So they have an attitude either your force or against us. If police are not working with the insurgents, then the prime target insurgents is to knock off treasonous police. And they also attack people of their own group who are influential, who are not on their side. You know, I hate to say it, but, you know, look, for example, the American Revolution. The people who are collecting taxes for the king got tarred and feathered. So I think where we're going, people, is when the boiling point starts increasing, members of America's patriotic Americans who see that they're getting shafted by the system are going to start finding ways to not only provide positive incentives to educate the wealthy people in this country about the importance of republic virtue, but frankly, there's another side. They're going to start getting more militant about punishing them as well. So I think that's coming. I think that actually, if I'm going to summarize, there's nothing new under the sun. Everything we're experiencing today has happened before in history. It's just people don't want to face up to it. And frankly, I think that, for example, I've wrote in places about this resistance manual by Major Fondock Byrne called Total Resistance, handed out to all Swiss citizens about how to deal with an occupying force. I think that the pointers in that manual quite likely, where he summarizes resistance movements through history, are probably going to become a blueprint for what a lot of Americans are going to be forced to do. They, in the future, they just don't want to accept the gravity of the situation, accept the reality.
What was the other statement we were discussing earlier today that you have on your side about history and the past? If you don't know the history.
Yes, from George Orwell. Yeah, from 1984. Some words to the effect that he who controls the past controls the present, he controls the present, controls the future.
Well, that may be how we have to end it for the evening here, and I really appreciate you filling in for Captain May.
Yeah, that was very informative and thought-provoking. Thank you, Bill.
Well, I appreciate your patient listening as I've covered a wide
range. It was excellent, yeah.
Yes, and thank you very much, Bill, for coming on today.
Well, thank you, too.
And this is... And again, thank you, Professor Carlstrom. And this is Truth Quest and KHEN LP 106.9 Salida. And I'm going to do.